Hello, good morning. TJ Schwartz here. You are listening to the Edge and Flow podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Lucas Burnley. We're going to talk about knives. We're going to talk about exciting new developments and a lot of tiredness. I can sense it. I feel
Churn.
tired. Maybe I'm projecting.
And it's also 6 o'clock in the morning, so it's like, this is like some end of the year like stacking, I think. You and I actually haven't talked for like the last 2 or 3 weeks at all, which is not typical. I think that is indicative of scheduling. Where should we start, man? I just got back from my show, non-show. You have a big update happening in the shop today.
I want to hear about the California dinner.
Okay, where do you want me to start?
So maybe rephrase exactly what it is because we talked about it several weeks ago.
Okay. So essentially, it was a small, like, trunk show, like a pop-up or a trunk show. We had it at one of our friend and collector's Thai restaurant, super small group. Basically, it was really interesting. This is like strategy stuff, I think, that carries over to all shows, but this, you really feel it on a small scale. So it's like, how do you create something meaningful for the people that are attending, manageable for the people like putting it on, and for me making stuff and timelines and stuff like that. And so it was a really, I think it was a really good exercise, which is essentially what this first one was. So I actually never promoted it. And this is like the first point where, kind of from the strategy standpoint, it changed while we were doing it. We posted about it in the Facebook group and basically said like, hey, we're hosting a dinner. They would pay like a $50 entry for the dinner and like the meet and greet. Okay. And then they had the option to buy what's it called? Like a show Sipop, right? So they could order a Sipop with their dinner, guaranteed score if you go. Okay. And as I was like watching the names fill in, what I realized was like, we're getting to the point where I feel like for a dinner, like socially, I can interact with all these people. And I recognized all of the names. I realized that if I were to post on social media, we would have sold out the rest of the spots because we're in a big city and there's enough like eyes on the page that people would have just seen it and come. But I also realized there was no guarantee like of fit, or I just didn't feel like more bodies necessarily like made it a better event.
Yeah, that's true for in a lot of scenarios, and I think this is a
Right?
perfect example is like
Yeah.
having the right minds in a room and not overextending, but just having sort of a core.
Yeah, just like a
Yeah.
core,
Yeah.
and also being a test and not really knowing like how to expect and how this is going to go. So I think we had about 25 people total. We had room for 50 people. So like from a sales standpoint, I'm like, okay, that's less sales. It generates less revenue like for the restaurant. But I realized like throughout, like this was not profit motivated at its base. Like everybody needs to make money to make it work, but maximizing profit was not like the highest concern. 3 hours, it was absolutely awesome. So Joey, Vin, and Chris, who owns the restaurant, Joey, who helps me and does shows with me, and then Vin, who is kind of like moderator for some different groups. He's friends with Chris. Like they put this thing together and it was really amazing, man. It ran super smooth. Basically, everyone that came in, they got badged. We did like kind of like a cocktail hour and appetizers that rolled into dinner and like kind of like a preview. Then we did the lotteries. Everybody kind of hung out, ate dessert, and split. It was 3 hours. I think probably like on the collector side, like just pure metrics, I think it's probably the best odds anyone would have ever had at a show for stuff that I'm making in the last decade.
That's cool.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, cause you look and you're like, I think I brought four folders, three Kihokus, four like Japanese style knives, and I think four like custom high end like Cypops. And there's 25 people.
Yeah. Really good.
Like the odds were really good.
It's more product units than more than 50% of the people, right?
Yeah. And I realized, and then the other people, like a good, I think probably 75% of them ordered a Cypop with the dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Which was also cool. Cause it, you see that that's actually wasn't what everyone was after. Mm-hmm. So like interesting takeaways from this would have been like, I was pretty sure it would be like a locals only thing, and you do it and you're like a Bay Area, right? We had it in San Jose. So you figure like you're pulling from a few towns. Like we had five people fly in.
Wow.
So, I think the majority of those from California, some from Nevada. I heard one guy missed a flight from Florida. But he wasn't there. But it just goes to show like, even at a single maker, small function, you're able to create like a pretty cool experience and like, I mean, opportunity for everybody. The opportunity for me was realizing that I was not going to be able to do another like full show this year. And still wanted a chance to connect with collectors, see friends, you know, and have some sales going into the holidays. Like it was just a win-win all across.
Yeah. I love the idea, man. The only bummer I feel about that idea is like, there's only a handful of locations you can pull it off. It's like, I mean, for us doing that in Boise, you know, we could get a few people, but it's like Bay Area, you know, Eastern Seaboard. It's like to make it work well, it's like you have to be pretty population dense.
You need population density, but like when you look at like major metropolitan areas, dude, I think there's enough that like, okay, if we were to do it again and we were to go like dry to a city and try to put it on. Like, obviously, you could run a poll. You could see, like,
mm-hmm.
I feel like if I had something in Chicago, I could probably get some people to come hang out with me.
Mm-hmm.
Where the question is, I think, is more around, like, what are you trying to do? What's the overarching value? Like, I look at it, like, from a cost standpoint, it probably, you know, you still have travel costs. You have, you know, I rented an Airbnb. But I was also able to tie it into spending time with friends. Doing some work with Joey because he's down in the Bay. So I think, and also I'm an introvert. And so like the social cost was a little bit less for me, which actually does tie into a show where I realized like we left after 3 hours and I was good. I was like spent. I'd been talking nonstop. The difference between this and a normal show is that I would get up and do it again the next day.
Yeah. And you weren't coming off of 10 hours of a show floor.
I wasn't coming. Yeah. And that's what it felt like. It felt like basically imagine your entire show is just like the dinner after the show.
That's amazing.
I didn't do sales. Okay. I didn't handle any of that. Didn't do the lotteries. So that is one of the elements I think that is really unique about this type of format because it frees you up to actually be social.
Yeah.
Like if someone has a question about something, they come and grab me and ask me and we talk about knives. But for the most part, I'm detached from that. I don't know if everybody has that, but it's really nice for me.
Yeah.
So
no, I agree. I love the idea, man. It really has my gears turning about I mean, I feel like it'd be a little different for us how we would apply something like that. But I mean, just how can you not wait for community opportunities to happen, but like drive them, I think is the key. It's like, you know, somebody has to put these things together, and
yeah,
it might as well be you, might as well be me. You know what I mean?
Well, and I think we've talked about this a little bit. So like right now there's a lot of shows. Okay. I think there's some like maker fatigue. There's some collector fatigue in that you're having to like pick and choose like where you are. Whereas, you know, 5, 10 years ago, you had the things that you didn't miss. Right now it's like almost everything is good enough to not miss.
Yeah.
But if everything's good enough to not miss, like what do you do?
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I have this like sneaking suspicion that you will see more of these type of events,
which is as cool.
it really is. And it's, I think it's kind of fun because I'm sure there's frustration. Like it's frustrating to miss something, but the stakes are lower and you're not missing like your top five favorite makers because you're not going to this show or something. You're missing out on one maker's event. But if it happens more often, I think it creates one. I think it's really good for local. Dude, it's nice for like collectors and makers to hang out and see each other. Yeah. And if you can do that on a small scale with people that are actually in your area, that's really valuable.
Especially in a little bit of a show off season.
Yeah.
Right now in the winter, you know, there's not really a lot of shows. Especially
absolutely.
The Bay Area in the winter, you know, if someone's flying in from Nevada, maybe that's pretty nice.
Yeah. Nice little break. I mean, so I also think that it like this one worked really well because we had the opportunity to hang out at Amarin, which is Chris's restaurant, and the food was awesome. It's like, it felt like a really nice catered event where like the food never stopped. Everybody took home like leftovers. Like it was just like a rad, like it wasn't like stuffy or like, it wasn't like a banquet hall or anything. It's you literally just hanging out and like eating street food in a small restaurant, like hanging out outside.
Yeah.
But I think that like brands can do this or makers can do this in a way that feels like super authentic to either a product line, to their customer base, to them, where it's like, dude, you could just be like, hey, I'm going camping.
Yeah.
We're going to go camping. And if you're hanging out, like come with us.
That's a lot. Yeah. Yeah. That's along the lines of what I was picturing. If we were to do something, because you hear big YouTubers will have like their Patreon or whatever it is, or some, you know, kind of close group that they have, and they'll do like a camp out and, you know, invite certain people that are in the follower base. And I mean, I've never been to one of those. Dalton, he's into the motorcycle world. He went up towards you over in Bend, Oregon and met up with a YouTuber who was setting something up like that. And they went on a motorcycle ride. And there's so much power in that. That is so
it's the power of community, which like everybody talks about community, right? It's funny now because I hear it like more and more around brands, and you're like, what are you actually doing to build community?
Yeah, there's a buzzword aspect to community that it gets used, I don't know, out of its original context, I think. But then there's actual community.
Like actual community. And that I think is what the main value of small events like this are. It was funny. I was on the drive back up and we got an email from a local shop that I really like asking if I wanted to do a pop-up there
in Bend or
in Bend.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. And I'm going to try to have a call with them maybe next week.
Cool.
I don't think I can do it before the holidays, but it's like a perfect fit. And that's the same thing where it's like, I don't ever do anything local. And so they feel like, obviously they are not linked, but they feel like linked somehow, where it's like, okay, I know that I'm struggling with maintaining big show presence. So maybe it's not doing shows. Maybe it's just a realignment of the size and type of show for a time period.
Yeah, I like that.
There you go.
No, that's really cool, man.
It was pretty good. I went to be honest, like just as like make or talk, like I probably went too hard on product. Like when I was done, I looked and I'm like, this is basically me getting ready for any major show. Like, but
Right.
it felt good. People were psyched. Like we, other thing that we did was we did lotteries, but because it was really small, I didn't do any auctions, didn't do closed bids. Obviously that affects like the total like revenue, but I just wanted to have like, I just wanted like really clear like pricing on the
Yeah,
table.
keep it simple.
Keep it simple.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I got back, day before yesterday and I'm kind of like putting back the pieces 'cause leaning into it, it was basically, I don't know, 7 days a week for 3 weeks.
Well, here we are.
Here we are. All right, your turn.
Well, I hope I don't come across distracted at all because I do have an ear next to the exterior wall of my shop. And if I hear a semi truck with a low boy trailer pull up, then I'm going to have to jet because the X9 is supposed to be here in approximately an hour to an hour and a half from right now.
Oh man.
So, we got plenty of time to record. I think we're great, but I keep hearing a noise
They're
outside. I'm like
like,
waiting
what
for
is
the
it?
driver to knock on the door or something, but yeah, that's what's happening.
Dropped off. Okay, when did you order the
A
X9?
long time ago. So I ordered the X9 in April.
Oh wow. I was thinking like summer. Okay.
It was immediately after getting into this shop, which we got in late March. It had to have been March, April, probably April. But this isn't normal that you would wait this long. This is the first batch of X9s to ever come stateside. So I was jumping in on what was effectively like a claimed spot on
Right, like
almost
a
borderline
pre-order.
pre-order,
Yeah.
which was made clear that it's like this is we but when I ordered, I don't think they'd shipped any of them anywhere in the world.
Okay.
And so it was still R&D a little bit on the very tail end. And
Right.
then I knew that we were going to need it this year, and I just hoped it got here this year, and it did. So that was kind of all I really wanted out of it. So we just kind of waited, and they gave me the phone call a couple weeks ago and said, "Hey, it's in Houston." So we put together, the rest of the planning, get it shipped up here. So today's the day.
Did they help you with like putting together the rest of the move? Like, did they have a
So
moving company that they work
the
with?
LTL I never talked to once.
Wow.
So I just told him when, and it just happened. So
It happens.
yeah, so the only thing I had to do is I had to call a rigger, obviously.
Yeah, on your end.
On my end, I had to
Yeah.
call a rigger, and so I called the rigger, and then Sile America in Houston, Wesley over there, he put the rigger in contact. I believe it was him put the rigger in contact with the LTL. So
Okay.
it once they were in contact, I could kind of stand back a little bit because if they're
Now it's
talking,
like
then I don't
handled.
really have to do anything. So I knew that, today was the day. The only thing that was funny is I knew this morning, the 15th, was the day we were going to be receiving it. And yesterday at like 9 in the morning, the driver of the truck calls me. He's like, "Hey, I'm almost to your shop." And I'm like, "I don't have a forklift that can lift 12,000 pounds. I don't know if you do, but it's not going to work." So I called the LTL company. I found like the invoice and stuff, and they just said, they're like, "Yeah, drivers tend to do that." So it's like they hope that everyone they're delivering to is ready as early as possible, even if there is an agreed upon time. Because as a driver, totally understandably, the faster they can deliver, then the more loads they can pick up because they're
Right.
usually
Right.
semi-independent. I don't know how all that works, but so I had to go on a little goose chase and call everybody and be like, "This isn't going to happen, right? You guys can't unload this." And the rigger's like,
Oh
"Definitely
man.
not. We cannot unload today." So I had to, unfortunately, the driver's camped out somewhere waiting for this.
Oh man.
So
Like over a timeline, it probably works out for them. I mean, what do you think? Like, you're delivering a big machine, 50% of the shops that you reach out to are like, oh yeah, come on by.
yeah, and
I mean,
a lot of machines I could have found a way to get it unloaded. I mean, there's a lumber yard, there's forklifts within a few hundred yards from me, but this thing weighs
yeah.
12 to 13,000 pounds, so it's the forklift that the rigger is bringing is their big one, which is, probably
12,000 is a big machine, man. I mean, I'm for us, that's a big machine. It is the, what's the X7 weigh?
40 or yeah, 4,200. Yeah.
It's three of those.
Yeah. It's like, three X7s.
Wow.
And it's not very much bigger. I mean, it is, but it's not, I think the X7 is 59 inches wide.
Yeah.
Which is 5 feet.
Yeah.
And the X9 is 6 feet wide or something. Or no, it's like 7 feet wide. So it's only like 18
much
inches wider.
Deeper?
Not really.
It's just all mass.
It's just the casting, if you look at the pictures, is crazy. It's giant.
Wow.
Yeah, because the X7 is like really classic C-frame shape. So yep. Like if you've ever seen like a Bridgeport, it just looks like a giant caliper.
Yeah.
Because it's the shape of a C. And that's the way the X7 is, which is normal. And then the X9 though, the casting is way wider at the base. So okay. It's like the machine, if it's like 7 feet wide, the casting's like freaking 6 feet wide. And then it comes as like a pyramid to the top of the column. From the outside perimeter, it's like a giant triangle to the top. And so if you look at, I got a picture of the casting from the factory, and it's like the whole machine, it's like there's less sheet metal to make that machine and more casting because the whole back is just casting. Right. It's crazy, which is very unusual because you look at like a Haas VF2, it's the exact same. It's like a C, and then there's just sheet metal all around this C. And this thing is like, it's not like that.
And this machine going straight into grinding.
Yeah.
Okay.
I only have one holder for it, and that's, I'm not even going to buy other holders for a while. It's just one cup wheel holder to start.
Okay.
So I won't even be able to use the tool changer for the foreseeable future.
Interesting. So here's a question, because we had talked about this like when we first started talking about reeve grinding, which was, ultimately, you didn't need to buy a new machine to do this process.
I needed a machine.
You didn't need to buy like a brand new off the floor. So what was like the criteria for you ordering a brand new machine that's over? Like you said, you don't even need tool changes, really. Like, what was the argument?
So, being as someone who has not actually done this grinding myself, but who has been peripheral to it through several of, you know, other organizations I've worked with, it seems like the bullet points were through spindle coolant.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to go out and find that, which you can get that in a used machine, Cat 40 at least, which was one of the main reasons I had to get a different machine. X7.
BT30 on the X7.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I want to run big wheels because I want flat grinds basically.
What is big?
6 or 8 inches in diameter.
That's big.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And so you need at least Cat 40, because if you see a 6-inch wheel on a BT30 holder, it looks stupid. And it is. So basically it put me into the category of like, do I want a VF2?
Right.
New or used, or an X9. Can't get a used X9 because that doesn't exist yet.
Doesn't exist.
So I mean, an X9 is less money than a used VF2. So it's like,
that's crazy.
And if you got an old VF2, you know, like a 2005 VF2, that's doable. But the problem with the risk of older controls is that you want as smooth movement as possible. And in order to do that, you may end up with a high point density in the code, which means reading a lot of code fast.
Right.
In order to have, you want, if you have any like triangulation in it, it's extremely obvious because you're out on the periphery of this giant wheel. Mm-hmm. Whereas like an end mill on the perimeter of like the tang of a knife, if you have low point density, you get these little facets. Well, it's exacerbated like exponentially when you add the radius of the wheel. So you need like either you need really good smoothing in machine, or you need really tight point density. And the controls that are older, it depends on the manufacturer from what I've seen, but it's a little riskier that you're not going to get.
Is that like fall into like when you read about like look ahead or like the high speed?
Yeah. Machining. High speed machining, but also like I've seen some Okumas do this grinding, and they seem to smooth better. And it's just like an inherent, even the older ones,
just due to their controls.
And the Haas seems to struggle with it. Even the new ones. And I don't know. It's like hard to know because it's intrinsic to the way that the machine is reading code. And
right.
I don't know exactly, but
so it's unknown. I mean, basically, yeah. Like you right now, you are comfortable with Sile. This machine came out. It had all the features that you needed to be able to like do this theoretically well.
Yeah. And it does have
that makes sense. I was just curious because I mean, it's still like, it's a big buy-in for a single, you know, process, but
yeah,
not really.
Yeah, it is, but it isn't because if you look at how much time I have Dalton stoning blades,
yeah,
and how long it takes the X7 to mill those bevels,
yeah.
If it didn't net us any increase in output, like let's say a month from now, 6 months from now, we still had the same output,
yeah,
it still I think is net profit ahead because of it's going to save us a lot of headache and a lot of just general pain around milling bevels. It's just not very scalable. I'd much rather pay someone to be really good at running the bevel grinder as opposed to stoning bevels. Like that's just a better situation.
Makes sense.
And so yeah, it's gonna net us some growth I think in our output, but even if it didn't, it still works. Because I mean it was $62,000 delivered. That's with the freight. And it's like we're living in a day and age where 62,000 is like the entry of entry levels for CNC mills. Even used Haas VF2s with like through spindle coolant, you're at 60.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like other than like small machines like the X7,
yeah,
that's just kind of what you're getting. It's just
it's interesting. It's like from a process standpoint, I think that direction of like at the point where there is an option to do it, even if it doesn't increase like overall numbers crazily or anything, reducing an inefficient process or trading an inefficient process for an efficient process long-term, like you said, long-term, I think that makes like a huge amount of sense. Yeah.
And it's scalable. You know, it's like we call it the Reeve method, and Reeve grinds all their knives this way. And that's a lot. Right. I mean, they have like 50
it's
employees.
A lot. Yeah, I thought it was interesting. I saw the one comment when we posted the reel kind of saying like, well, this isn't an ideal solution. This is a workaround. And as I was reading that, I'm thinking like, well, yeah, I get the sentiment behind it. Like if you have a product line where like, you know, burger grinder makes sense and you have the finances, but like so much of what we do as makers is problem solving to our scale. How do we do this? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's also like levels of like what ideal means. So pure numbers based productivity, like, sure, I would agree with that. Like, this isn't like the nth end all be all of production grinding.
Mm-hmm.
What it is, I think, is a very flexible and effective and, you know, cost effective version that also gives you some really unique flexibility.
Yeah. I mean, it's got a 24 tool changer arm type, like side magazine. So and the table's, from my experience with the little machines I have, the table is gigantic. You know, it's like whatever it is, 20 by 30 travels or something crazy, you know? And it's like with all that travel, I mean, I can fit all kinds of pallets on there for my smaller products that I make. And if we're grinding and we're like, holy cow, this thing can grind enough that it only has to grind a day a week.
Yeah.
Then it's like, okay, I'll put seven or eight other holders in that 24 pocket holder changer. And it's like, it's just augmented.
It's back to just being another machine.
It could make scales. It could make sheaths. It could make tangs. It can grind. It can, there's not a single operation that we do that it can't do.
Be interesting to just put all of the processes that people say will break your CNC machine into that CNC machine and see how long it lasts. Like you can't run grinding wheels in a CNC. You can't mill G10 in a CNC, like all of these things. Yeah. I'd be very curious. Just all abrasive.
You're right. And what I do have to kind of call out, like, so our Tormach is this come, it's in the next couple of months, few months, it's going to be a 5-year-old machine. It's run every single piece of G10 we've ever put out, which is a lot of G10, like a large mm-hmm. amount of cutting G10,
yep.
for 5 years, almost every day. And it's like, it's fine. I mean, nothing's happened, you know? So, I mean,
it's holding the tolerances that you need to hold tolerances.
On. Yeah. On scales is depending on how you're designing the knife, you know, like what do you really need out of the tolerances on a set of G10 scales? Yep. You want it to be pretty good, but you know,
argument would be like, you could run like some test parts now and see like, oh, what tolerance does it hold? But yeah. I like that idea anyway. Like if you have grinding belts, you can only use them when they're sharp, or you can stage them and have like, oh, okay. When it's done on the main vertical grinder, it can go to the horizontal grinder because the way the grit is used is different.
Yeah.
CNC is no different than that.
And if the Tormach ever did start to just kind of, it's got dovetail ways, which means once they start to wear out, there's just no coming back.
Right.
As opposed to like linear rails or something.
Right.
And so if you could replace the ball screws, if that's a necessary thing, but if it ever starts to go to the wayside, the nice thing about something, a machine like that, is it's very unlikely that it's going to get to a point where it just won't operate, because they're very easy to work on. The parts are cheap. It just might get sloppy.
Yeah.
And if it does, there, I don't see it ever getting sloppy enough where it can't make Kydex sheaths.
Exactly.
So I see that machine continuing to run for us for at least another decade. And if it just slowly works its way down to where it can't do G10, which I haven't seen any indication of that, it's still valuable to us.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's, I don't, the whole like G10 and abrasives in a mill, it's definitely not untrue. If you were like an aerospace shop and you had to make like tenths tolerances, and then you got this job where they want 1,000 pieces of G10, I would see where that would be problematic. But if you're a knife manufacturer,
and you're making knives,
you're making
this is
knives,
one of our, is like one of our materials. Yeah.
Then, I think that stress is just totally unfounded. There's just no reason to worry about it.
It's a maker urban legend, but it is like, I would say like, if it's the cleanliness, if you're like, no, I don't want to run a little bit of G10 in this machine because I run coolant and I'm going to just like coat my machine, I get that pretty.
Yeah.
You know, that's understandable.
Yeah. And it depends on what you're looking to do. You know, it's, everyone's situation is different, but when you're running like true production, it's like, yeah, set aside a machine, it's going to be a dirty pig,
gonna
and
run,
it's just going to run G10. Big deal. Yeah.
Oh, I love it, dude.
Yeah.
So it lands on the floor today. When do you think you will have it up and running?
So I got the jump on this a few weeks back and made sure I got my grinding wheel ordered, my tool holder ordered, and I'm having 5-axis fixtures made for this so that I don't have to make them. I reached out yesterday to double check on the fixtures and on the wheel because I hadn't gotten them yet. Unfortunately, it's going to be at least 3 more weeks for one or both of those.
Okay.
So I've got 3 weeks to get this thing wired up, get it filled with coolant, get it level, no pressure. So that if I had all the stuff, I might be under a little bit of stress right now of like, I want this grinding on Monday, which that's totally out of the question. So it's kind of a nice feeling actually to just familiarize myself with the machine. Maybe we'll run it through a couple programs just to see, make sure everything's working right, but we're not gonna be able to cut anything really with it. So it's just kind of a slow burn until hopefully in December. I want to be grinding by the end of the year for sure. But it's kind of out of my hands. If we get the parts, we do, we don't, you know, is what it is.
Nice.
But the only other thing is, I don't know if, tell me if I've, we've talked about this on the podcast, but a face mill holder is what we're using to hold this wheel.
Okay.
Just a standard face mill. It's just an arbor with dogs on the sides of it.
Yep.
So the bolt in the, it's a through spindle capable holder with a through spindle pull stud, which means there's a hole going through the middle, right?
Yeah.
But the bolt is just a bolt. There's no holes. And so the way that you would run through spindle coolant on a face mill is the face mill has its own channels because you have to get it out to the cutting faces.
Right.
And then usually it has a bolt designed for that so that the bolt seals the bottom of the face mill, because you don't want coolant going out the middle of the face mill. You want it to go through the channels.
Yeah.
So those have their own setup, but this holder it's just as a bolt because it doesn't know what you're going to, it's just a bolt, you know? And so if I put a wheel on it, the coolant can't make it through. There's nowhere for it to go. And so, what I've seen is somehow we have to modify that bolt or to make some kind of bolt that has a hole through the middle of it, but then near the head needs to have a bunch of holes that that create 90 degree travel, because you need the coolant. If it just shoots straight out of the middle, it's not going to go where you want it to go. You need it to like change direction and get out towards the skirt of the wheel.
Right.
So in those 3 weeks, that's my number one thing that's still on my plate is to, I was thinking if I bought a grade 8 bolt with the same thread pitch and then, you know, drilled a hole down the middle of it, like a decent size hole.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then
yeah.
drilled holes in from the hex face.
Yes.
To intersect that middle hole
at like 90 degrees.
Yeah. Cause you just need coolant to get inside the bolt or around the bolt and then get to the outside of the wheel.
Yeah.
So I got to figure out a game
and then
plan.
Would you cap the center hole or something?
I would try not to, I would blind drill it from the back.
It from the back.
So you know, don't break through the front
of
the
bolt.
Oh yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
And then around the hex.
So you could like you could plug weld it. You could do like, there's some other things you could do too.
Or thread it.
How
big
is the bolt
in it? It's big. It's a 1-inch arbor and the screw is like 5/8 or something like that. So it's a pretty good size.
Yeah.
You could easily put like a 3/16 hole through the middle
and
of it.
And the reason that you couldn't or wouldn't modify the bolt that comes with it.
It has an
Allen head and it's probably round.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. If it didn't. Yeah. You need to, the Allen in the middle is going to create a point where they all meet all your holes. You know what I mean?
It's funny. I have no experience with having parts like made. Is that like a send cut send part where like, or one of those services,
like, I mean, obvious like Zometry machine or
shop.
Whatever.
Yeah. Zometry, so, something like that.
So Tim over at Chris Reeve, he offered to help because they have lathes and they have had to solve this same problem.
Okay.
But
is that how they've done it?
Yeah. Similar. Yeah. The idea that I'm describing is a adaptation of what they've done. So it's been solved before if I had to go that route, but I do think I could just, like I said, buy a grade 8 bolt that has the right thread pitch and just start drilling holes in it. I think it would work as opposed to making a whole part.
I get because that like balance and stuff like that. I just don't know. Like if you think about like drilling for balance, if you're drilling manually inside of a grade 8 bolt, like with, and is like, what is the quality of the bolt? Is the bolt head concentric? Like,
that's valid.
I don't know if it matters or not, but that's the only reason that I could see having
balance would be the issue there.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's an interesting thing. Dalton does have a lathe, so it may be ideal for him to drill it in a lathe as opposed to, you know, freaking trying to drill a straight hole with a drill press or something.
Definitely. And then you could do it in the mill with like, you know, like a collet closer or something like that.
Indicate off of it and absolutely get it. It is, you're dead right that like you have to think about how centered and square and tight and straight all your holes are, because if you know you throw it off to one side,
it may not be noticeable. Like with grinding, I don't know the RPMs. Things in there. There's too many variables.
Yeah.
But it seems like having that as a machined part would be better than using like just an off the shelf like grade 8.
Yeah, probably. Well, the only thing I would say though is you're probably right. Yeah, that's the next 3 weeks. That's probably that's the only real thing in between me and grinding. The only thing is we could grind without it briefly. So had we had the fixtures and had we had everything, I would probably be starting to grind and also R&Ding that bolt.
Oh, interesting.
Parallel process.
Yeah.
But
because you could,
I
mean, theoretically, like you could just, even in the one that you have, you could drill through the Allen. You still drill through the bolt. You could still have coolant coming straight through the center. That's probably better than nothing. Right. And who knows? I mean, maybe you could even modify that to have like cannulars or something like going out. Oh, it's super interesting, dude.
Yeah.
So, okay. December, you're going to be like in, feels good going into, you know, the new year.
Yeah. Yeah. And what I was just thinking right now is I could probably have Dalton throw that bolt in a lathe face off the head to make sure that it's very true and parallel. undercut the underside of the head to make sure that that's nice and true. Mm-hmm. And then you could turn, you could take a hex head bolt and turn it to take the lobes down a little bit to make sure you'd be able to tell if, because a lot of forged bolts yeah. are not
concentric,
very concentric.
Yeah.
But you would, if you turned it a little bit and then to put a pair of calipers on it and measured how much was coming off of each lobe.
Yeah.
You would know pretty quickly how concentric that head is.
Well, you could also do it. Yeah, you could turn it regardless, just leaving small flats.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of ways to do it.
Yeah. So yeah, that's I'm still into like being creative. What's my plan phase on that? But like I said, nice. I do have like 3 weeks because I don't have a wheel or a fixture. So
it's exciting, dude.
I'm very excited.
And just normal production. Like you guys have just been cranking.
Normal production. We had a little bit of a hang up. Q4 is always, we always see upticks in sales in Q4. This one came kind of suddenly and that's great. You know, I'm not complaining, but we did get into a little bit of a pickle with the blades of our knives. You know, we have to order the steel. There's a lead time. We have to get it water jet. There's a lead time. We have to get them surface ground. There's a lead time. We have to machine them ourselves, which we can do as fast as we can, but that's the only thing that we can control. And then heat treat, there's a lead time. Yeah. And so if we get a little bit behind the eight ball because of like a surge in sales and I'm like ordering steel and trying to catch up, there's this period where it's like, it's out of our hands. You know what I mean? Right. And so if each of those lead times is like, oh, it took like three extra days. Well, at the end, that's like 2 weeks, you know? So that sucks. So we got into a little bit of a pickle. And so I've had to get a little bit more aggressive recently of like, we need more supply chain saturation. We need more steel in the works. We need more inventory on the blade side. Because we have to have more resilience against a surge that could happen.
Right.
And we've been a little bit too tight on that. So we did run into it like this last week. We thought everything was going to work out like just in the nick of time. And heat treat is getting busier as well. And they took an extra week, which is unusual. Usually it's like 3 days they heat treat and turn it around. This time it was like 8 days, which is still fast. But it was like, oh, we do not have knives to finish this week. So this week in the shop, we literally, on Monday, I called the heat treater. I'm like, any knives for us maybe? And they're like, no, it's going to be the end of the week. So I just went out in the shop. I'm like, all we're making is LT5s this week. Yeah. That's all we have. And that is a cool feeling though, because when I designed the LT5 with all these different processes and materials, there was a part of the motivation, which was that it doesn't use our surface grinder. It doesn't use the same steel supplier. It doesn't use the same handle material. And it's doing, all the processes are so different that if like three things went wrong on the MagnaCut stuff, that knife, there's a good chance it's still actually going to be makeable. And it just worked. So if we hadn't had the LT5 with all these different parallel processes, we'd have literally been sitting on our hands for a whole week. So it was
just a testament to diversification.
Yeah, exactly. It worked
even
out
inside of a system where it's like, yeah, this is still, we're still making a knife, we're still doing this. Like you have enough variation in there to like create some security.
Yeah, which feels great, because if you're kind of beholden to, you know, CPM for MagnaCut to show up, I mean, there are companies like Benchmade and Montana Knife and Buck Knives. Right. It's like, hey, we're doing a 10,000 piece run. We'll take everything you got for
you're
the next six
small,
weeks.
Small fish.
And then it's like, if all I'm making is MagnaCut knives, I mean, I guess I'm out of business for 6 weeks. You know what I mean? Which that is one of the main reasons why I wanted to bring A2 on. Is because it can be made by like three different people.
Yeah.
So it's very unlikely that I'm not going to be able to get A2. And so that's part of it. And this week was the week that it paid off. So
yeah,
that makes
I think I'm, that's basically the rest of the year for me is trying to, I need to basically update some standard models. So I want to make some upgrades to the Tuna, the Quaken Framelock, so that they are more like, just slightly more efficient. This last round, like getting ready for the show, after coming out of working on Kihokus, I'm really feeling everything that I'm doing that's inefficient. or just like not even inefficient in like the original context, but like compared to what I know now and some of the, like, I can just look at it and be like, okay, an upgrade here is like way less time for me downline. Mm-hmm. So that's my next show is Blade, Texas. The plan is basically to spend like a month or so getting back into the production on a few of my other models, but like really trying to take the time to improve them. Mm-hmm. New fixtures, like, you know, some hard milling, stuff like that, going into folders. And then also trying to, now that like the Kihoku is like pretty well running, starting to like really try and get a little bit more of like a supply chain going. Yeah. To where it's like, okay, every month, you know, maybe it's 20 knives for me, but just making sure that I have everything I need and the time to make those 20 knives every month.
Yeah.
Which is foreign to me.
Yeah. It'd be fun. But
yeah, I'm excited. So yeah, man, that's pretty good. It's like, there's a lot. It's a lot of year. I was this morning before we jumped on, I was just kind of thinking about like all of the changes this year and like growth and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty fun. It's busy. I'm now working to unschedule myself because I've been going so hard for so long. I'm like, I just have this like nervous energy where if I'm not working, I'm kind of uncomfortable and I don't like it. So
another feeling.
Yeah. Trying to get back to a normal schedule, normal days of the week, and like roll into the holidays.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yep. Yep. It's
I feel good, man. I feel like that is, you think that's probably the show today?
Yeah. A
couple big updates.
Yeah. Some big updates. And like I said, I keep listening. So
yeah,
maybe I should go walk and make sure he's not.
I think it's time for you to go, you know, watch for the mailman.
Yeah.
So, all right, guys, thank you for listening. For those of you supporting us on Patreon, we appreciate you. As always, leave us a question, drop us an email, let us know if there's topics you guys are curious about or questions you have. We'll see you around.
You bet. Thank you all. Have a good week or weekend or whenever you're listening.
Day. Later.
Peace.